In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Noah Tarnow. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
It is super exciting to have you here. We were just talking about it off air. We have not recorded a podcast together since my wife and I were in San Francisco for our honeymoon, where we actually got to have dinner with you, which was an absolutely marvelous way to spend part of our trip.
Yeah, it was great. It was, the irony, of course, is I am also from New Jersey, but I left
to go to San
Francisco to meet. I left the East Coast behind, I'm a traitor. But it's
so
funny,
envious.
I live here for 8 years, and people still, and I lived before that, I lived in New York City for 18 years. And to this day, people meet me and they're like, oh, are you from New York? Are you visiting from New York? You're so New York. Like, it just doesn't go away, the attitude, the personality. New York area till I die, for better or for worse.
I guess so. Well, okay. Well, very cool. We're here to talk about Super Friends number 46, which, as everyone knows, is the penultimate issue.
Good word.
Of Super Friends. We are getting, it's a big vocabulary word. we're getting near the end of this series. But of course, Noah, you haven't been on the show before. So I have to ask you, what, if any, history do you have with Super Friends, the comic?
Well, like so many dorks of our generation, the Super Friends TV show was like holy writ for me.
Sure.
I watched it as far back as I can remember. It's a big reason why I'm a superhero geek. It's a big reason why I've always been a DC kid as opposed to Marvel, especially like among my circle where Marvel seemed to be more popular. I was like a rebel for liking DC more than Marvel. But that cartoon just always caught my imagination. And, I had comic books since before I could read, as far back as I can remember. And my sister used to tease me because before I could read, people would give me a comic book, and the first thing I would do is I would rip the cover off. Yeah, you believe that? Well, none of these were valuable. There were people were buying them off the stands in like 1978. So I would rip the cover off. I would look at the pictures and I would add it to a big pile. I had a big pile of coverless comics, and I am almost certain there were some Super Friends comics in that pile.
Would you then resell the comics for credit? No, was it a scam they were pulling?
No, they have returned to the dust from whence they came long ago. But I do recall clearly, it must have been the summers of 80 and 81, because, this series stopped publishing in mid-81, late-81 or something.
Mm-hmm, mid-81, yeah.
I remember going to day camp those summers, day summer camp, and a few of the later issues of Super Friends kicking around there, being passed around. I remember the one with Plastic Man fighting Hammerhead, whatever his name is, Bullethead. Warhead. Thank you, Warhead. I knew that.
Warhead.
Yeah. Very important. Very important. But by the time I had any discretion and I was actually reading comics and picking comics, I would see Super Friends comics in friends collections. People would have comics that were 5, 6, 7 years old, and they always seemed like weak sauce to me compared to, the real thing, Justice League. They were for little kids. So, I'm sure I dug them before I could read, but by the time I could read, they really weren't my thing.
Hmm. Okay. So did you had a, you had a perception that this was like, was it like a kid's book? Did you think you'd know that?
Yeah. Yeah, this was the kids thing. Justice League was the big kids thing, the teen thing.
Right.
When I would watch reruns of the Super Friends, I always liked Challenge of the Super Friends better because I liked the bigger group and the villains, and I didn't like the Wonder Twins. I mean, oh, the Wonder Twins show me how to, you know, be safe while riding in a taxi cab or whatever, or, you know, cut the segment of Aquaman showing you arts and crafts, you know, like those are the Super Friends seasons that like, I wanted the more serious stuff. And I remember the last two seasons, you know, the Galactic Guardians where sure. they brought in Cyborg and Darkseid and Firestorm. And those just like, oh, we're a step forward here and we're showing Batman's origin. So I always wanted to take it one step further, the more adult thing. And this comic kind of represented like the kid's side of Super Friends.
Gotcha.
So, you know, it didn't really catch my eye when I'd see issues around.
All right. Fair enough. So, okay. So before we get to the story, the Conqueror's greatest conquest, it's tough to say. Let's talk about the cover a little bit. It's by Kurt Schaffenberger and Bob Smith. It is full, I would say, and then you've got 6, 7, 8 figures, mm-hmm. not to mention the little serif bubble up at the top. By the way, everybody, of course, this is a serif backup, which is awesome. So what do you think of this cover, Noah?
I like it a lot. I really do like it. It's one of these, it's busy, but it's great. You have the Conqueror, who, you know, we met last issue. He's sort of in this rectangular force field. And for some reason, he doesn't have his cape. I was looking at him like,
oh no, I guess he doesn't. Yeah, you're right.
And I was comparing it to the drawings inside. He doesn't have his cape. And he's like, ah, ha, ha, no one can beat me. As the superheroes are trying to break in, Superman is punching it. Batman is swinging in. Wonder Woman's got her lasso around it. And all the kids' favorite, Wild Huntsman, is smacking it with his broadsword. And then Aquaman, Godiva, and Robin are defeated on the floor. I like it. I like there's this sea green background mm-hmm. that I think is a really nice color. I like the logo has this like gradient color from red at the top to like light orange at the bottom. And I looked on Mike's Amazing World at all the past covers of Super Friends, and they never did something like this in a previous issue. It was always a solid color, the front of the letters Super Friends. So that's a cool effect. I guess whoever colored the cover decided on that.
That's unusual. Yeah.
Yeah. It's neat. It's a different thing. I wonder what goes into those decisions, but I like it. I will say that there's a couple issues here. One is I'm having trouble with the perspective here. Like, where is the floor here? Like, Aquaman, Godiva, and Robin are on the floor, but then Superman's standing on the floor and Wild Huntsman. It's just like, once you look closely at that, it kind of hurts your brain. And then what is Batman swinging in on?
A tree branch that we can't see.
Or an invisible rope or something.
Or he's the Batplane. The Batplane is up in the sky and he's lowering himself down.
But he looks like he's holding a rope, but you see like his arms lead to nothing. His hands lead to nothing.
That's
so
true.
I mean, these are nitpicks, you know, it's a cool cover, but I will say, Rob, that it's a Kurt Schaffenberger cover. I am disappointed. I'm doing a Super Friends comic and there's neither the cover nor the inside is by Ramona Freyden. Because
sorry.
It's totally okay. So, story I have to tell. Just last week, I met a young a kid named Ramona. I have been hired to something I do sometimes, host a quiz show at her bat mitzvah, which is next month. And, you know, what I do for these bat mitzvahs is I learn about the kid, I learn about the likes and dislikes, and I sort of meet them on, you know, video call. So she had told me that she really likes comic books and that she and her friends have tried drawing and writing comic books and they haven't been able to finish it. And I'm like, oh, you like comics? Have you ever heard of Ramona Freyden? Because I think, oh, Ramona, I think Ramona Freyden. She goes, no. And I go, she was one of the few female comic book artists in the 60s and the 70s. And she's 50s. Very influential. 50s, going way back. And she drew Aquaman for a while. Figure, you know, everyone's heard of Aquaman now. And she didn't seem to care. She didn't care.
Oh.
She wasn't, I know, it's sad. So, like, good thing I didn't go, hey, have you heard of Metamorpho? You know,
so. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you could bring her some Ramona Brenda Starr or something. Maybe just seeing it would click something. Yeah. I don't know. If she likes to draw, maybe.
She does. Yeah, no, I think she was more the writer on the comic.
Gotcha.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, she just didn't seem to be like one of these people who's like, yeah, so they have the same name as me. Who cares? I did like this kid a lot, though. Interesting kid. But her bat mitzvah will be fun.
If you want to impress her even less, you could play her the Bob Dylan song To Ramona.
Oh, okay.
All young kids love the folk era Bob Dylan from 1964.
So there's before we're recording, you were saying Ramona Freyden's the only Ramona you've heard of, but there's.
Well, I meant
Bob
in real
Dylan.
Life. I meant in terms of a person. I've never, but yes, of course, there's the Bob Dylan song To Ramona. So you could do that too. So there you go.
And then listeners, interesting fact about your host, Rob Kelly, he had never heard of Ramona Quimby. which I find stunning.
I think some people are listening to this are like, who's that? Explain who that is for people who don't know, like me or dumb, don't know.
Catch me next week on the Beverly Cleary cast. There was a writer who many people of our generation, she wrote kids books. I think she's still alive, like over age 100.
I believe she is. Reading that I was like, wow, she's still around. Good for her.
Has crossed the century mark, and she wrote a whole bunch of kids books, and they were, you know, recurring characters, a bunch of kids. And one of them was Ramona Quimby, who was a little, book was called Ramona the Pest. So she was this brat. She was this little kid and she caused trouble, and her name was Ramona. So that's the first name I think of when I think of Ramona. Number two is Ramona Fraiden. And number three is this kid who's having her bat mitzvah.
There you go. Well, I mean, Ramona Fraiden is like 98. So maybe there's something about the name. Oh, by the way, you mentioned Beverly Cleary is no longer with us. She died in 2021.
Okay.
But she was 96. So
96.
God bless her. I mean, it's an amazing life.
For some reason she was over 100, but I guess
it's not. But she did, by the way, I should mention, just to tie it in, she died in Carmel by the Sea, which was where my wife and I spent part of our honeymoon, as we did having lunch with you in San Francisco. So it all ties back together.
There are no coincidences in this. Woo!
All right.
No coincidences.
I apologize for not giving you a Ramona issue. I really do. we talked about you being on the show a while back, and I was just scheduling it all out. And then I was like, oh, we're getting down to the last 10. I got to get Noah on the show. And by that point, Ramona.
Perfectly okay. It's fine. I love this cover. Kurt Schaffenberger's great. Not to tip our hands, but I thought the art in this issue was pretty good too, but we'll get into that.
It kind of reminds me, what you mentioned about where Batman is coming from. There was that thing a couple of months ago where that horrible thing where AI art was taking famous paintings and expanding it to see what AI could do, which was like, who the hell wants that? Like, why do I want to see the surrounding elements of the Mona Lisa? I don't care. But they could do that for this cover, you know, where you could just expand it all out and show that Superman is not standing. He's actually floating. He looks like he's standing, but he's floating. And Batman's coming down from the bat plane and laying off to the side, just outside of Godiva and Robin Rockman, are like the rest of the Super Friends. So there you go.
It's a good use of technology for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is.
I mean, I would rather they put AI to work on doing that than making everyone's job obsolete. I would rather they expand Super Friends covers. So
that is true.
That's the choice.
Fair point. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the story. As I mentioned, it's called The Conqueror's Greatest Conquest. It is, of course, by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ramona Tengel, and Vince Coletta. It was on sale April 23rd, 1981. The Super Friends and the Global Guardians continue their mission to rescue the six supervillains trapped by the Conqueror. Superman and Olympian find a floating metallic box containing the World Beater. Last seen in Super Friends number 3. Unable to break into the cube, our heroes take the easy way out by going back in time to the exact spot the cube will be in 100 years. They then go back to the future, landing inside the cube. Easy peasy. With World Beater's help, Superman and Olympia destroy the cube. Of course, World Beater then tries to take out his liberators, only for Superman to take him out with his X-ray vision. The Wonder Twins and the Wild Huntsman travel to find the Time Trapper. He is trapped inside a glacier guarded by robots. While the Wild Huntsman smashes them to bits, the Wonder Twins melt the ice prison and grab the Time Trapper. Robin and Rising Sun head to the desert and defeat some armed goons stationed there to guard Hector Hammond, trapped inside of a bubble. Once they get inside, Hector Hammond informs them that the Conqueror came to him and Sinestro, saying he wanted to help them defeat their mutual foe, Green Lantern. Then he double-crossed them both, leading Hector Hammond to now being willing to help the Super Friends defeat the Conqueror. The Super Friends and the Global Guardians, along with Sinestro, group outside the Conqueror's castle. He greets them with his own prisoner, Dr. Mist. Using the various superpowered devices he stole from the villains, the Conqueror robs Olympian of his golden fleece and uses Wonder Woman's magic lasso against her. Suddenly, though, Sinestro's power ring, which the Conqueror was using, disappears into a puff of smoke, the work of Dr. Mist, who then uses his powers to strike crippling fear into the would-be World Conqueror, leaving him a quivering mass on the floor. Dr. Mist then warns Sinestro to rethink his evil ways, which he actually seems to consider. The collected heroes ask if Dr. Mist could have done all that all along. Why did he need their help? He explains that his great power should only be used sparingly, lest they get out of control. Plus, he was confident that the Super Friends and the Global Guardians would succeed, since they are the real conquerors. All right. Now, what did you think? Well, okay, you've read the first installment of the story.
Yes,
you mentioned. Yes. What do you think overall of this as a two-parter?
It's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I like the art. I like Romeo Tangal. I think he's mm-hmm. got a real kind of clean. I remember some of his entries from Who's Who, standing out to me. Like, he was usually an inker, but when he would draw, you know, he was in the vein of Schaffenberger and Frayden, which is perfect for a kid's comic. You know, bright, colorful, smooth. So I like the art. The story is bonkers. And I'm even going to say it's not good, but it's enjoyable, you know, for the most part. I mean, it serves its purpose. There's a lot of action. There's a little bit of characterization, but not too much. You see all sorts of different heroes teaming up, fighting bad guys. There's craziness that isn't like, you know, like too hard to grasp while still being crazy. So I enjoyed it. I think it has a lot of flaws, though, you know, which I'm sure we'll go through piece by piece. But for the most part, you know, it's a good story. I do wonder why they did a two-parter in Super Friends, because this comic, more than most comics, even back then, had to have been, you know, how many kids were subscribing to Super Friends?
Right.
This had to be more, you know, definitely on the end of kid just randomly picks up an issue when they beg mom at the supermarket kind of thing. Versus this slightly older kid who makes a point to pick up Justice League or Teen Titans every week, you know, every month, right?
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, however many subscribers Super Friends had, it wasn't enough, since this is the next to list issue.
That's right. Know. That's right. So I don't know. It seemed like an odd choice to do that, but maybe Ian B was like, I like the story. You know, I can't tell it in one issue. And maybe he knew it was on the way out. So he's like, you know, screw it. I don't care anymore. I'm doing what I want to do. So yeah, I don't know. It's an odd choice to do a two-parter here, but you know, it works. It's a Super Friends story. I guess I do wonder if this issue would be completely undecipherable if I hadn't read the first issue, but, I don't know. It's impossible to know.
We say this a lot on the show, in that most of the plots written by Ian B for the comic would have worked pretty well as an episode of the show. This one, especially. I mean, obviously the Global Guardian never made any appearances in the cartoon, but they, I guess they could have, or at the very least, they could have subbed out these characters with Samurai and Apache Chief and El Dorado and stuff like that. But it has that, you know, they break up into, like in the first chapter, they break up into smaller groups and then they go off and do this. And the bit where Superman and Olympian decide that the easiest way to get into this bubble is to go back in time. That is right out of the Challenge of the Super Friends, where Aquaman did that.
Thought of the same thing. Yeah. That is the most bonkers thing that ever happened in that series.
Yeah. I'm going to bury this thing, this communicator, because it's nuclear powered and it has a half-life of 100 trillion years that I wear on my belt near my crotch. I'm going to bury this.
Yeah.
And then in a million years, we'll be able to find it again. Like, the internal logic of that is so Inception that Chris Nolan would be like, that's impressive, guys. That is
One of my favorite parts of that is to do this scheme. Aquaman's lucky he's with Apache Chief, because Apache Chief has to use his tracking powers to find the exact spot where the Hall of Justice is going to be in 57 million years. So they can bury it there, and when it goes off, Superman can hear it.
That is like chef's kiss logic.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
it's incredible.
Really is. It really, really is.
That that leads me to a question, which is, I wondered while reading this, do we know why E. Nelson Bridwell created the Global Guardians instead of just using the, you know, Apache Chief, Samurai, Black Vulcan? Or had they not been created yet by the time he was?
No, they had been created. I don't think, I'm going to guess they didn't have the rights to do that. Those were Hanna-Barbera character. Yeah. I mean, they've still never appeared in any DC comic. They've never used Apache Chief or El Dorado or Samurai.
Versions of them appeared in Justice League Unlimited. And I mean, I feel like they were adapted. Well, Black Vulcan was created because Tony Isabella wouldn't let him use Black Lightning, right?
Yeah.
And Samurai was used in the Superpowers miniseries because they made a Superpowers.
Oh, that's right. He was. That's right. Right. Yeah, what am I talking about? Yes, of course he was in that series.
And
that's
I feel like there have been, you know, monkey versions of Apache Chief in the comics. They certainly started, they used Wonder Twins here and they started using them in the 90s in Extreme Justice or whatever it was called. So I don't know. I mean, that would seem the logical move. Maybe they tried. I mean, Global Guardians are a more interesting concept to me. They feel a lot less pandering. And at least, you know, as you've talked about before with Seraph, and we'll talk about again, like Seraph doesn't feel like, hey, let's have a Jewish guy. Like there actually was some thought going into
it. Oh, certainly. Certainly.
Yeah. I don't know if a Greek person reading this would be offended by Olympian and think like, oh my God, you don't understand our culture at all. But these characters definitely seem more interesting than, you know, the token, whatever we want to call them, racial characters that were used on the cartoon.
Right. The diversity characters.
Diversity. Diversity hires.
They were known as, they were known as.
At the Hall of Justice.
I have to assume at the point, at least at this point, they were still considered Hanna-Barbera's property and they weren't to do it. And Ian B was a company man. You know, he wrote books, but he was through and through a DC company man. And I think he was trying to do right by the company by giving them characters that could be repurposed. And I've mentioned before, I don't read ahead. So I have not read number 47. I read it, you know, 30 years ago, but I haven't read it again since. I will read it obviously very shortly, but I don't know whether in the letter column to number 47, there is any indication that they know this book is canceled. The letters page in this book gives no indication that it's canceled. It's not like, hey, next issue, this is it. But at the same time, I can't believe that Ian B didn't know the book was on its last legs. And he starts using Green Fury, especially a lot in these legs. Yeah. She's in 43 and 44. Now she's going to come back in number 47. I have to think that he was trying to say, well, the book's wrapping up. Let me give these characters as much of a boost as possible so they can be used by other writers, you know, and of course they were. I have to feel that's kind of what he was doing here.
Well, I mean, also it says here the next issue is a 25-page blockbuster.
Right.
So there's no backup story.
Right.
And they say with Green Fury and, you know, she's done better than almost all these characters. But frankly, look, I haven't read new DC comics in 15 years, but like, I feel like most of these characters have been underutilized. Like they tried bringing back Dr. Mist like in the late 80s, and I don't really think that took. And of course, Fire and Ice got a big boost. But like, have we seen Godiva and Wild Huntsman and Bushmaster?
Yeah,
like,
most of these are pretty obscure. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Seraph, you know, you've talked about in this podcast how much potential I feel like was squandered there. And we'll talk about that story. So, you know, I guess despite his best intentions, like if he really wanted to, and that makes sense. You're right. Give him a boost before he's on his way out the door. But I don't really think it worked out the way he hoped.
No, I don't think that it did. They basically appear in the DC Comics Presents two-parter.
Yes.
And then they get their own Who's Who listing. And that's about it. That's about again.
They were in Infinity Incorporated there was a story arc there.
I read that book. Yeah. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was, I remember because it was also, it was when they first fought Injustice Unlimited, you know, that new Injustice Society. Yeah. And it wasn't like the full panoply of them, but it was a handful of them. And it was Green Fury and Ice Maiden. So that had to have influenced, you know, Giffen and DeMatteis putting them in Justice League Internet, although they were changed pretty radically in that series. I feel like they were, and then of course, a bunch of them were in there, like, you know, Jack-O-Lantern show up in there. Around the time the podcast that Shag is doing right now, I recorded an episode with him a few weeks ago about Breakdown, sort of the end of the JLI Bwahaha era. And yeah, the Global Guardians show up in there. Most of them don't do much, but Jack-O-Lantern is basically, he's like a villain there. He becomes a villain. So they've popped around, but you know, we're talking about comics that are 35 years old now. And also like, there was a lot of potential. Like some of these guys could have been, you know, maybe not A-list, but B-list. And
yeah. Absolutely. So chapter two, we've got the Wild Huntsman with the Wonder Twins and they rescue Time Trapper. And you know, Time Trapper, we know that he's a big Legion villain, but at least in this book, he is a mort. I mean, he is a giant mort. I mean, he got defeated by Gleek in a previous issue. And here he gets freed from the ice prison and then they just knock him out with an ice fist and that's it. I mean, I know they don't have a lot of space, but he is. You know, you're like, if you're a Legion, you know, fan, it's like, oh, he's one of the big bads. And you're like, this guy, really? You could just trip this guy and he's defeated. So
how did he become, why did they put him in Super Friends? Like, why did they put a Legion villain in Super Friends?
I don't know.
Very strange to me.
Don't know.
Like, what's next? Mordru in the next issue or, you know,
don't know. It is such a shame. Ian B just, well, there's multiple reasons, but Ian B did not live long enough to like, kind of be embraced by the later kind of super fandoms of the internet. Like he didn't live to see the internet. You can imagine him on the internet.
Oh my
God. Because he just would have been being interviewed left and right for all of his encyclopedic knowledge of DC.
Exactly.
Comics.
Yeah. I do find it funny that so Time Trapper, like all of these villains, except Hector Hammond, he betrays the Super Friends and the Global Guardians after they rescue them. And he says, and now as a reward, I will use the science of the controller universe to destroy you, my enemy. I just think that's very clever that as a reward, I'm going to kill you. Yeah, there's some crazy ideas here.
Absolutely.
By the way, speaking of Morse, I didn't get to say this. It was bothering me forever what World Beater looked like. He looks like, do you remember Frankenstein Jr., that cartoon from the 60s?
Yes.
He looks like Frankenstein Jr. Like, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I'm not, but like, how am I supposed to take this guy seriously?
See, I love World Beater because he's so goofy looking. I love him. I love that he looks like a 1950s robot monster, you know? I think that characters designed by Ramona Fraiden are a little tough to render if you're not Ramona Fraiden. I think her stuff has a certain intrinsic quality to it, sort of its own rules, kind of. And when someone else of a slightly more realistic style, which is Romeo Tango, tries to draw it, it just looks weird. But I really love World Beater. He's got this antenna spinning around his head.
Yeah.
I dig him a lot.
Yeah. They never brought him back, have they?
No, just this
these
is
two
it.
Issues. Yeah.
This is it for World Beater.
I do think it's funny that if you go back to that story where he's introduced, he is a badass. Like, he kicks the Super Friends' ass. He beats up the Justice League. He says, I already beat up the Freedom Fighters and the Blackhawks. And then it's just Superman going, no, you know, I know how to defeat. He's like defeated in half a panel here. So it's not the only instance of Deus Ex Machina in this comic. I will say that.
Yeah. That's always the trouble with when you do an issue where all the villains are teaming up. I mean, here, this is not all, but you've got, you know, three here and three previous, because then they have to be way less effective than they would normally be. I mean, World Beater got a whole issue to himself, and here he's taken out in two panels. It's like Batman number 400, where like all of his villains break out of Arkham and attack Batman. And then all of a sudden Batman is taking out like the Penguin in one punch. You're like, wait a minute. It took him 3 months to do that a couple of years ago. Like, what's going on? So
I obsessed over that issue as a kid, and something interesting, it wasn't just everyone breaking out of Arkham. It was everyone breaking out of Arkham and Blackgate at the same time.
That's right. That's right.
He mops it up in one issue. But like 3 years later, everyone breaking out of Arkham at once is, you know, leads to him being crippled for 2 years. So, you know, we got to change the standards depending on the point of the story, but you know, hey, it's comics.
It is. I love that comic. Okay. So the chapter three, I love that you've got these cowboy guys defending Hector Hammond. They're all, I love, they all kind of look like they're the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, sort of. It's kind of a fun thing.
I don't understand why. Okay. So the Conqueror, this huge, you know, nigh omnipotent, godlike evil being, he gets robots to protect the Time Trapper. He gets these crazy monsters last issue to protect Kanjuro, but he gets these goons from a bad 70s action movie to protect Hector Hammond.
I absolutely love it.
One of them, they say it's hot out. One of them's wearing like a parka and a ski hat.
Yep.
What is his deal?
One guy, even at least three of them have at least like a cowboy type hat, like a wide brim hat to keep you from the, It's like, what? Like, what? You know,
can I ask, this chapter is subtitled Hammond Dry. What does that mean?
Obviously it's like the inversion of Hammond wet, but I don't know what Hammond wet means. I don't know what that means. Is that a thing? I don't know.
I've said it 10 times to try to see if there's some pun I'm not picking up on. Like, what, Hammond dry? Like, actually Hammond is Hector Hammond, but like, what are we missing here? It's really bothering me.
Yeah. I know. I never really thought about it, but you're right. I don't know. Was like some sort of 70s thing? That
I Googled it and I didn't find anything.
Well, all right. Now I'm looking at it here. The only thing I can find, and this is a reach, this is a super reach, is that there's a company that makes dry suits for water sports. It's called Hammond. Is that what he's referring to? That seems unlikely.
Did dry suits exist in 1981?
That's true. Yeah. Right. They might even be. I don't know. Yeah. See, damn it. Nelson Bridwell needs to be around to answer all these questions.
Reason he's been dead for 30 years.
That is,
that's
yes,
why.
His family or anything, he can answer a bunch of his
life,
questions.
Not his soul.
Yeah, no. No, rest in peace, Nelson Bridwell. Indeed. I love the story beat that the whole reason, like, this is going to lead to his defeat, the Conqueror's defeat, is because he double crossed Hector Hammond and Sinestro, which, you know, like, well, he's a villain and villains always have to double cross each other. Conqueror's like, I'm not going to share the planet with these two idiots. But it's like, he really didn't need to do that. And then if he had not done that, Hector Hammond wouldn't have helped them out, but of course he did, and that's leading to his defeat. So,
well, he's the only, Hammond is the only one of these villains who doesn't double cross the heroes. So, I guess one of them had to. I will say, in this scene, Robin is a badass. You know, I feel like in the Super Friends, Robin is often made to look foolish, like even worse than the Wonder Twins. He's just sort of Batman's appendage. But when he, that panel on page 11, he punches one of the goons. It's a real good looking punch.
Like solid right hook.
Solid right hook with a big pow. And, you know, they say like George Perez was the only one who could make Dick Grayson look cool in that costume. But like, he looks pretty cool there. And not only does he punch this guy, the guy falls back so hard, he elbows another one of the goons in the nose. Like, it makes Robin look like a real tough guy. Yeah, I really bruiser. Like, yeah. And this is like, those are my favorite moments of Robin when it's like, yeah, you know, he might not be as dark as Batman literally in terms of color, but he's just as much of like an ass kicker.
And he karate chops another guy in the neck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jumps and hits and grabs the guy's hair and like pulls his head to the side and karate chops him. Like, it's pretty good stuff.
Dodging automatic gunfire. You know? And then he figures out, you know, Rising Sun can't figure out how to get Hammond out of this bubble. And Robin uses his detective skills. I'm impressed with Robin in this scene.
Yeah, good use of Robin in this story. By the way, I should mention Rising Sun. One of my complaints about the Global Guardians is they are way too ornate for their own good. Like, you need to have, there's that classic bit where they said that, like, the way if you want to design a character, design somebody that looks good in a silhouette. They're recognizable that way, and that's how you know, that's a good design. A lot of these characters, Wild Huntsman or Tuatara or something, they just have too much going on. But Rising Sun's uniform is this, you know, one piece, and he's got just the red, you know, he's got the Japanese symbol on his chest, and then he's got red boots and kind of flounced sleeves. It's a really elegant design. And so that, to me, again, made me think of all of them, of all, you know, like, he should have been one of the ones that rose a little further to the top, just because he just makes for an attractive package. Like, he just looks cool. When the guy who's dressed for winter, criming, shoots Red Sun and he's in like silhouette, like, and he's just standing there with his hands on his hips.
Yeah.
He looks great. He looks great.
He does look good. Yeah. I will say though, you said Wild Huntsman is too ornate. I actually was thinking in chapter two, I really like the way Wild Huntsman looks, especially that panel lower left on page six, because he looks, I mean, you could say he looks like a Thor ripoff, even though this is German folklore as opposed to Norse, but he just looks like probably a stereotype of like an old European, you know, hyper-masculine warrior.
Oh, totally.
So he's got that kind of Thor appeal, like a god literally made as a superhero. So I think he could have gone somewhere, you know, to fill that niche of the superhero who is taken from like legit folklore, legit literature, legit stories.
Yeah, like I said, there was something here for a lot of these characters.
Absolutely.
So then we get to the final confrontation. I love all the superheroes ganging up outside the Conqueror's castle. I absolutely love Romeo Tangel drawing Aquaman with his arm around Sinestro. It has got such a just slight, like, grabbing him by the scruff of the neck kind of thing. Yeah. I absolutely love that. Like, he's just like, come on, you punk. I love Sinestro, this most powerful creature. I mean, obviously he doesn't have his ring, so he's just a regular, he's just a magenta dude. But there's something about that Tangel took the time to draw Aquaman with his arm around, just kind of like, you know, all right, come on.
However, in the same panel, Godiva has her arm around Bushmaster.
That's friendly, though. That's a friendly.
I was wondering if, like, we're supposed to interpret them as a couple. And then as soon as I saw that, I'm like, well, are we supposed to interpret Aquaman and Sinestro as a couple? Which probably not, because Aquaman says Sinestro wanted to come along, so we brought him, you know, to explain why he was there.
Why he's there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a lot of
exposition in the story, but that's okay.
Yeah. So then they break into the Conqueror's castle, and he again uses his powers. He puts the whammy on Superman, pulls the Golden Fleece off of Olympian for a moment, uses Wonder Woman's magic lasso against mm-hmm. her. Then he grabs the Sinestro ring, all only for it to disappear. And then we see that Dr. Mist, this was a sort of not a trap, but a thing that Dr. Mist is pulling. And then we get this kind of, you know, interesting panel where Dr. Mist, his hand is all of a sudden floating, and we see that Conqueror starts looking absolutely abjectly terrified, and he falls into a heap, and Olympian's like, you know, Himmel, he is now nothing but a quivering, cowering Hulk, a complete wreck. And Dr. Mist explains, you know, basically sort of like did the old, you know, when you stare into the abyss gazes also into you kind of thing. And it's like, you know, it's an unusual story beat for E. Nelson Bridwell to try to work into a kid's comic. The concept of the guy is simply terrified into collapsing. That's a slightly more adult way to end the story than you would expect for what they think the age group for this book was.
I kind of feel like this last scene is where the wheels come off of the plot.
okay.
I like some of the details. I agree that panel with, you know, Dr. Mist floating hand is cool. I like that Conqueror is reduced to being terrified and not just defeated. I love Sinestro basically has a face turn. Dr. Mist says, you know, you should learn better. And Sinestro goes, they were evil and they're against me. Perhaps I should think things over, alter my life. I'm just picturing Sinestro in therapy now. So there are details. I like Wonder Woman saying hooves of Pan. I think that's a great exclamation for her. But first of all, they get there. Conqueror says, look who I have here. It's Dr. Mist. And Dr. Mist is just standing there. So it makes you wonder, okay, is he hypnotized?
Right.
Then Conqueror starts kicking the butts of the Super Friends and the Global Guardians solely with the use of Sinestro's ring. So this supposed godlike guy, basically all he did now is he just took this one weapon. Why did he have to kidnap these six guys? One weapon, and he's beating them all. So couldn't have Sinestro done this? And then Dr. Mist just goes, nope, I'm going to stop you. Boom. And essentially snaps his fingers and defeats it. It felt very Deus Ex Machina to me. It felt very much like, what was Dr. Mist doing there before that? Was he standing there? Was he hypnotized? Like, I was thinking like, well, couldn't we have a thing like, okay, he is hypnotized, or somehow the Conqueror put this whammy on him where he can't use his power. And we see Dr. Mist in one panel fighting it. Fight it. You must save the Super Friends. Fight it. Breaks through. He does his thing with the hand. Conqueror is reduced to a quivering bowl of jelly, etc. It just felt really like EMB was wrapping it up really quick, really fast. He ran out of ideas. Again, the details are fun. It works. I like the art through the end. So it's, and again, I like that idea, like you, of a villain being reduced to being terrified. That is unusual for a superhero comic. But I don't know, it felt awfully quick and pasted on to my mind.
Oh, a lot of these stories have that. A lot of these really,
I guess.
They're 17 pages, and a lot of them are, you're on page 16 and you're like, my God, how are they going to wrap this up? And then in like six panels, they're like, up the end. You're like, wow, all right, we're really abrupt here. I do love the way Romeo Tangle drew the Conqueror looking terrified, like just really, that's his staring into the camera. Dr. Mist's whole thing of like, yes, I could have done this the whole time, but my powers are so powerful, I have to use them sparingly, lest to get like, what?
Yeah,
what? Exactly. You know, exactly. What? Come on. Then learn to use them a little better, Dr. Mist. Like, what are we talking about?
So was he standing there going, well, let's see if the Super Friends and the Global Guardians can do this on their own. But if they can't, I'll step in. And he's finally like, yeah, they're not getting the job done.
I guess so. I guess that's what he's saying. Weird. Yeah. It's
very weird
detail. I also love the next to last panel where the Conqueror is still on the floor, kind of cowering and blubbering this. And Robin's pointing at him and laughing, essentially, which is great. Ha ha! He's doing a Nelson Muntz, you know. Oh, look at him, he wet himself. Okay. You're like, wow.
Yeah. You thought the beard was bad enough. Now he's crying like a little baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well,
that costume is ridiculous, by the way. Like, that is a wacky costume, the Conqueror.
It's again over detailed. It's over designed. But so that's the end of our big two-parter. It's kind of a weird way to wrap it up. But, and, you know, obviously the Sinestro reverse heel turn did not stick. because he, you know, as soon as he got his yellow power ring back, he's like, oh, screw this. I'm going back to going to kill Green Lantern. So that's our story, everybody. So for this issue, Noah, who would you rate as the best friend? Who do you, I think I know your answer.
Oh, yeah.
Who do you think came off the best?
Yeah, I'm going with Robin.
Yeah.
Especially since, you know, partly because I called that out, no one else really jumped out at me as like, I mean, Superman's, you know, thinking through the time travel thing. And by the way, I love, he asks Olympian, hey, can you time travel? And Olympian's like, I bet I can, but I've never really, it's never really occurred to me before. Like, oh my God.
Thing to assume about yourself.
Right. Like, if I could time travel, I'd be taking advantage of that as soon as humanly possible. Yeah. Superman's shows that he's pretty smart, but especially when I was a kid, I kind of had this fondness for Robin, you know, as the underdog kind of thing. So, you know, kind of hearkening back to the days when I might have read this. I mean, for all I know, I did read this story in 1981. I just don't remember. So, you know, I feel like sentimentally, I want to like Robin here, and I do, because he's kind of like Robin at his best, or his best for a Super Friends comic. So yeah, I would give it to Robin.
I would agree. I think he did a great job here. They give him a lot to do. He looks really cool. And yeah, he takes out like, you know, all these guys. I mean, yeah, they're just regular crooks, but he takes them all out basically by himself, which is really good. And he doesn't always get a lot to do, you know, because like, obviously they've got other, you know, characters to bigger sort of characters to deal with. Regarding time travel, you know how I know that I've never discovered time travel? Because I am not currently living on my private island. That's how I know. Because if I had access to time, to a time machine, I would go back to 1938 or 39. Yes. Yeah. I would buy Action Comics number one, Detective 27. Just before I left, I'd kill Hitler. Don't worry about that, everybody. I'd kill Hitler and get those comics and then resell them for millions of dollars and invest that money in like Apple in like 1978. And then I would be living on my private island.
You and you'd be the only person who could think of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Do you know the story about the guy who bought a dilapidated old house for $10,000 and there was a pristine copy of it back in like the 70s and there was a pristine copy of Action Comics number one hidden within the walls?
That's insane. That's nuts.
I might be, some of the details might be off, but like a guy bought a cheapo house to tear it down and build something in the lot, and Action Comics number one was in the walls.
Why? Why?
Because someone hit, I don't know, someone thought it was valuable or just hid some comics in there, some old comics. It's like the story about, you know, the copy of the Declaration of Independence that was found behind the old painting.
That I've heard.
That Rob Reiner now owns that copy of the Declaration. Like, this is the dream. Like, you stumble upon this crack, but like, you know, you might as well win the lottery, which isn't going to happen, by the way.
So. No. That's insane. Wow. That's insane. Okay. Yeah. Well,
good luck.
Yeah. So before we get to Seraph, the Seraph story, I just do want to mention the letters page. There's a lot of praise for Bob Oxner and his work on the Seraph, which again, we'll be talking about in just a second. But there's a detail here where it mentions in the letters page that he does, you know, occasionally work for DC. He does Superman Family. He does the Lois Lane strip. But he also writes the newspaper strip Dondi, which I did not know. I didn't know that he wrote that strip or that he had any connection to it. The reason I even bring it up is because Dondi, for most of its run, was drawn by Irwin Hazen, co-creator of Wildcat and my former instructor at the Joe Kubert School. Really great, fun guy to talk to. I didn't know that him and Bob Oxner worked together on Dondi. So that's pretty cool. I never read Dondi. It was not a strip.
I didn't know you went to the Kubert School. I had no idea.
All right. Okay. That's enough with your sarcasm. as much as we enjoyed that opening story, let's get to the good stuff, which is, as always, the Seraph back.
Yeah.
Because much like the other two Seraph stories, this is the winner, right? This is the winner story here. And by the way, this story is so complex. This 8 pages or 9 pages.
Yeah.
The synopsis is almost as long as the one from the main story. I tried to boil it down as best as I could, but
they pack in a lot. Yeah.
They pack in a lot. So, okay. The story is called Echo of Evil. It is written, penciled, and inked by Bob Oxner, which is amazing. Chaim Levon, aka the Seraph, is introduced to his girlfriend Rivka's cousin Wendy, visiting from the States. They plan to take a tour of the Masada, the former pleasure palace of King Herod. Haim gives Wendy a brief history of the spot, explaining how 100 years later, Rome sacked Jerusalem, causing one final battle with the Masada, resulting in the death of almost 1,000 Jews at their own hands rather than being enslaved by the Romans. Suddenly, Haim has a vision of the deserted camp below, now filled with Roman soldiers, as if he was seeing the past right in front of him. Wendy and Rivka don't see anything and think that Haim is having delusions from being out in the sun for so long. Soon, the vision disappears for Haim, except for one Roman soldier on horseback. That night, Haim sees the soldier again and changes into the Seraph to meet him. The soldier says he is Flavius Silva, commander of the 10th Legion, here to defeat the Zealots at the Masada. Flavius was given the duty to sack the city, but when the Jews died by their own hands, he was denied that glory. And since tomorrow is the anniversary of that event, when almost 1,000 Americans will be visiting the Masada, he is returned to fulfill his destiny. Seraph and Flavius fight, and the noise awakens Rivka, but she cannot see Flavius, so to her it looks like Seraph has just gone mad. In the middle of the fight, Flavius casts down a lightning bolt onto Seraph, knocking him out. Rivka thinks he is dead. Suddenly, Seraph's staff turns into a snake, attacking Flavius and killing him. Seraph awakens and sees that where Flavius stood, only a pile of dust remains. The sun now rising, the Seraph says he is ready to give a tour of the Masada, almost as if he had experienced its history himself. Mm. Wowzers. Okay. What did you... Well, first of all, let's back up a little bit. What you told me you've read these other Seraph stories. What do you think of these stories so far?
Well, I like them a lot. You know, it's interesting that I read these stories this week and we're talking about it now because, as we record this, we're in the midst of the Jewish high holidays. We are between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur right now, the holiest week of the year in the Jewish religion. And I was raised fairly observant Jewish. We were very active in our conservative temple. But as an adult, I've basically lost the thread of Jewish ritual. I mean, I still believe in the underpinnings of the Jewish religion. I still believe in God, but like I go to temple maybe twice a year. But I did go last Friday night for the first night of Rosh Hashanah. And I've been thinking about it, my relationship to Judaism. And reading these stories now is, you know, it's significant. I'm still very culturally Jewish. I still identify as Jewish. It still means a lot to me. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that, as I'm sure you know, Rob, the superhero is largely a Jewish creation.
Sure.
You know, so many of the founding fathers of superhero comics were Jewish. You know, Simon and Kirby and Siegel and Shuster and Will Eisner and Stan Lee and Bob Kane. And in fact, to this, and I'm pretty proud of that. And even now, like when children of my family show an interest in superheroes, I always try to find opportunities to go, oh, you like that hero? The guy who created him, he's Jewish, like you, like me, you know, as a way to say, hey, you know, be proud of our people, your heritage. You know, they created this thing that's had such a cool effect on general culture. And of course, people have said many times how, you know, so much of the superhero stories, origin stories or whatever, are coded to be Jewish. You know, Superman is a Jewish immigrant. The X-Men are about, you know, how Jews are considered outsiders in their own country. But these Seraph stories are not coded at all. They are explicitly Jewish. I mean, this Masada story about the mass suicide of Masada, I mean, it's not from the Torah because it took place hundreds of years after that, but you know, we talked about it in synagogue growing up. I learned about it in Hebrew school. It was part of my religious education. And, you know, as a kid, I think one of the things that kind of caused a rift between me and Jewish practice was I just had this sense that Judaism was, you know, it wasn't cool. You know, I was a dork. I was a nerd. I was a tiny kid. I had issues with, you know, fitting in. I had issues with feeling like I was masculine enough. And these stories push back so hard on that. Because Seraph is super Jewish and he's super cool.
Oh, he's the manliest man to appear in any issue of Super Friends.
So in all the best ways of manliness, you know, he kicks ass. He protects people. He's got a hot girlfriend. He's a good looking guy. And he looks like the Bee Gees, but, you know, that's okay. I'm sure the Bee Gees did all right. You know, I just feel like Seraph is so Jewish while pushing back on all these negative things I was feeling about Judaism when I was the age of the kids reading this comic. And I have to wonder, you know, if they had given us Seraph stories in Hebrew school, you know, maybe I'd feel more of an affinity with the details of the Jewish faith than I do now. Hmm. Who knows?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, I am the first time they introduced him and he appears with in a team up with Superman, you know, hard to look impressive kind of next to Superman, but he did, you know, yeah. I'm like, yeah. And he has always been, I think, one of the greatest of the global guard. I mean, that's, you know, so I don't mean to damn with sort of faint praise there, but he really is to me the one of the standout characters. And it says something about, I think, that they chose him to have these backups. I mean, yeah, they did it to Jack O'Lantern too. And we, I know I was pretty, those are pretty dismal, but I mean, there's something about these stories again with their, I hate to even use the word explicit Jewish content because explicit has kind of a negative connotation. It's not, but we also know that for any sort of family entertainment, especially aimed at really little kids, they stay away from any sort of religious commentary, any sort. And to have these stories be so steeped in the religion and the history is, they were really taking a flyer here, really kind of taking a risk. Mm-hmm. And yet the reception, it was on the letters pages, was overwhelmingly positive. I think people really liked these again because they were so unusual. But yeah, Seraph is just everything you would want. He mm-hmm. looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, I mean, he's built like Hercules, but yet, as you say, he's sensitive. You know, he's obviously a very religious man, deeply religious man. Yeah. As you mentioned, he's got the hot girlfriend. By the way, Bob Oxner had the amazing ability to draw amazing cheesecake.
Yeah.
But it was the most benign looking cheesecake imaginable. Like he doesn't put, I mean, this is a kid's comic. He can't have women in bikinis or anything really, really prurient. But yet Rivka in her short shorts is absolutely gorgeous. You're like, man, yeah, he's got the super hot girlfriend. And then we in this one, here's my cousin Wendy, and Wendy is hot. Like Wendy's in hot too. Short. You're like, wow, this is just like, I want to hang out with Seraph. This is really cool.
I think you're right. I think that might be why Oxner was so good at drawing Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, you meet Lois was always pretty, but like Lois was a professional, right? Yep. Lois is a working girl. You know, way back then, even when she was, you know, Superman was fooling her for laughs. And then certainly by the 70s or 80s, when Lois was like basically a superhero, you know, she knew Kryptonian martial arts and all that
cook
stuff.
Lore.
So yeah, cook lore or whatever. Cook so lore. She would kick ass. So like, yeah, like what a good job of making beautiful women who still, yeah, were not prurient. In fact, might be, you know, powerful women who you don't mess with on their own terms.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And the body language he uses in page 4 of the story where Haim is hugging her, like just her head tilt and his hands on her waist, you're like, that's about as sexy so as cute. A kid's comic is ever going to get, because it's just in terms of they're pressing up again. I don't want to overstate this, but it's subtle. It's subtle. And then it's like, hey, these two are like adults in an actual like physical relationship, which is really, again, pretty cool when you're thinking about what the audience for this book was.
But this story, I mean, this story crosses a lot of supposed lines with a kid's comic. I mean, they talk about the suicide of nearly 1,000 people.
Can you imagine that? Yeah.
And then the deaths of 1,000 more. And then even that, like page 5, just how good Oxner is. There's that. So Seraph is talking to the, you know, the ghost or the demon, whoever is the old Roman general. And there's a shot of the Roman general up close, and he's got this almost maniacal look on his face. And then the next panel is a further close up of basically just his eyes. He looks really scary. He looks really, this is like something out of like an EC horror comic. The look on his face, the shadows, you know, really makes him look demonic. I mean, this is a frightening story for a kid's comic, a little kid's comic.
And then he kills a guy in the next page. He kills a Bedouin and his camel. He sets him on fire with his lightning bolt.
Kills a Bedouin. But one of the earlier Seraph stories, one of the bad guys is literally firing, you know, machine gun fire at children.
That's right.
I mean, these stories were intense. And, you know, I have to wonder with Oxner. I mean, yes, Ian B wrote the first story, but this story and I think the previous two stories are maybe just.
Yeah, they're both by all Oxner. Yeah.
All Oxner. And Oxner was Jewish. I looked this up. whether this was a bit of a labor of love for him, whether this was his way of going, oh, wow, a Jewish character, an not, you know, you can interpret it as Jewish, not the thing like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, he's Jewish. But like whether Ochsner, you know, maybe Ochsner was a really religious man. Maybe he went to temple every Saturday. And maybe for him, this was a way to take his personal faith and put it in his work. I can imagine that. All the more why it's too bad that Seraph didn't come back. Because yep. Especially trying to look at it as a point of view of a kid, like, I don't know. I haven't kept up with new comics in a long time. But have we had a mainstream explicitly Jewish character like this? Have we, you know, why not? Of the thousands and many, many Jewish professionals that have gone through comics since, you know, since the founding fathers, I mean, today, Greg Rucka and Bendis and whoever, and I'm sure tons of other people I don't know are Jewish. Like, it's really too bad none of them have done a religious Jewish superhero. I don't know. I mean, we've had, you know, we've had African American heroes created by African American creators as a way for them to, you know, put their identity into a superhero comic. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but I think we've done that for some other, you know, ethnic groups. And I just don't know if that's happened for Judaism, which is, you know, from my personal point of view, too bad. And Seraph would have been perfect for that.
Yeah. Yeah. These are absolutely terrific. It is such a shame that, I mean, you know, we know how I felt about the Jack-O-Lantern stories. I wish they had just ditched them entirely and just done more Seraph. I mean, I like the Plastic Man stories, although Plastic Man could have had a home somewhere else. But I mean, I would have been really happy if they had said, no, Seraph's our regular backup. That's just every issue. We're going to have 6 or 7 pages of Seraph because he's done 3 and they're all winners. So this character's batting 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrific. I mean, I'm sure there were elements of maybe they were antsy about the religious thing. Maybe they were antsy about, do these have broad appeal that a Plastic Man has? You know, I don't know. I mean, it's too bad we can't ask ENB. I mean, is there anyone involved with these comics that you could interview for the last episode of your podcast? You tell me.
I don't really know. Bob Ochsner is no longer with us and neither is ENB. So yeah, I don't even know. Julia Schwartz is not around. I mean, I don't even know who would even be connected to this to really even ask about it, which is, again, such a damn shame. And I don't remember what I thought about these stories when I was a kid. I just can't recall whether I read them and just kind of went, because I was not interested in any religious content. I wasn't interested in my own religion, let alone somebody else's. But I, you know, reading now, I'm like, they're exciting. They're well done. I mean, they're beautifully drawn. The page where the lightning comes down and we're in the silhouette of Flavius and Seraph looks absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, really good.
And as you mentioned, it's got an edge to it. I mean, Flavius dies by being bitten by this snake. This is Super Friends. People don't die in Super Friends comics. Yeah. But here, they're regularly getting, you know, as you mentioned, in the previous story, bullets fired at children, for Pete's sakes. I mean, God's, you know.
The fight on page 6 and 7 is really intense, even before the lightning. I mean, it is my favorite kind of superhero fight where, like, it really kind of feels and looks like people actually fighting. And this interesting moment where Seraph grabs the guy by the neck and he gives up. He goes, my neck, have compassion, I yield. And
it's a
trick. But like to be that explicit that like he grabbed the dude by the neck. I mean, this is some brutal stuff, even apart from the death and the reference to suicide and the snake. I mean, a lot of those religious tales were very, you know, the joke people make now is like, oh my God, the Bible is more violent than any other book you might find in a kid's library. And I think this reflects that those old religious tales, you know, they weren't messing around. And I kind of wonder if Ochsner and before that EMB were thinking that when they created these stories. Again, too bad we didn't get more of them. There's so much to dig into here.
Yeah, they're really, really good stuff. And one of the real pleasures of this show, as I've been doing it, is the sort of rediscovering of these stories. I mean, I knew I would enjoy Super Friends, but I just had no memory of these Seraph stories, and reading them over again, God, these are just a total delight. So, and I'm glad, you know, we mentioned in a previous episode, I introduced my pal Henry Bernstein to them. He didn't know they existed. And now he's covered them over on his show. And, you know, with that, for other people are learning about them. And it's just been terrific. So I'm glad. You know, we only got 3, but they're all really, really good. So
did Seraph come back at all? He was in the DC Comics Presents issue.
Yes. And apparently he did come back in like a like in the 90s as like a updated version, which people have warned me don't bother with.
Okay. And do you know who wrote that?
No, I do not. But apparently people have really said don't bother. And so I'm heeding that advice. So I'm just going to stick to what we've got here. So, but yeah, Echo of Evil, absolutely a terrific story and totally worth, again, I would say even the 50 cents just for this, you know, maybe as a kid, I wouldn't feel that way, but now I'm like, oh man, this is just awesome. So that is Super Friends number 46, everybody. The last dual story we will have in the book, as Noah mentioned, number 47 will be a full page, full issue story. So, we're wrapping it up here. So Noah, thank you so much for coming on by and doing this with me.
Thank you. Are you going to, when this series, I assume you're going to wrap up the series, this podcast, when you're done with the series, you're not going to move on to the cartoon or the 2000 Super Friends comic or anything like that.
No. Okay. And there will be, I mentioned this in previous episodes. I tend to like nice round numbers to end shows on. I hated it when DC Comics Presents got canceled with number 97. I was like, oh, come on. You know, what? So the plan is we will be covering number 47, of course. And then we will be doing, I don't know why I say we, it's me. We will be doing,
the royal we.
We will be doing three more shows related to kind of Super Friends related comic book content, wrapping it up with number 50. That's a nice round number to end it
good
on.
Idea.
So that's where we're going. So
terrific. Yes. Terrific. I've really enjoyed when you talked to Chris about the merchandise.
Yeah. Well, then you'll love the final episode.
Oh, we're gonna do a bunch of that for all merch kind.
It's not all, but we're gonna do a chunk of it because I really enjoy doing that. Again, I've said this on a bunch of episodes. Seraph should have been part of that Remco line that they had with
the
Warlord
Remco line,
and Hercules,
yeah,
where they were all built like Masters of the Universe.
Would have been perfect. I will tell you though, you talked to Chris on one of the Seraph episodes about that Ramona Fraiden drawn the slipcase of the little Superman books.
Yes.
That you didn't know existed.
Yeah.
I had that.
Did
remember
really?
It clearly. And not only did I have it, but I think I got it at one of those school fairs, you know, where
book
dealers would come in the gym. I got it like that, or maybe I got it from like mail away somewhere. But like, not only did I have it, but it wasn't just seeing it at a bookstore. It was some special offer. I wish I could remember, but I absolutely had that. I remember those covers clear as day.
That's
so
cool.
I feel like those were around when I was a kid. So they didn't sound that obscure to me, but I mean, there was so much stuff out there when we were kids, Super Friends, Superman especially, that you're always going to find things to discover there.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I love what Chris found. Those was absolutely amazing. He's great at finding obscure stuff like that I never even knew existed. I'm like, what the hell is this thing? So, well, anyway, Noah, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I always enjoy talking to you. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Well, I am all about the big quiz thing, bigquizthing.com. We are America's premier provider of corporate and private live trivia events, virtual in-person corporate events, private parties. I'm doing Ramona's bat mitzvah. We do the occasional public event. In fact, October 4th, we're doing, it's a Wednesday. I don't know. Is this going to be out before October 4th?
Yes, it will.
Not. Oh, okay. Good. What we call a midday trivia break, a 1 hour online game, a little break from your workday. See what we're all about, a free sample. So check out bigquizthing.com, learn what we're all about and get a free consultation and a free quote today. And I am also on Instagram at the Noah Tarno because there are now two youngsters named Noah Tarno, which kind of blows my mind because I was the only Noah I knew growing up. And now I didn't know any other people with my last name. And now there are multiple people with both. So, you know, just shows that there's nothing new under the sun.
May I ask, how does one do trivia for a bat mitzvah? I mean, what exactly are the subjects there?
It's a lot of fun. What I do for mitzvahs, which is I also do for what I call like private parties, like, you know, we'll do wedding parties. I mean, not really wedding parties, but like rehearsal dinners, like a birthday party, is we send a questionnaire. So for the mitzvah, usually one of the parents fills it out. Like, tell me about the kid. What do they like? What do they dislike? And in this case, this girl, Ramona, she filled it out herself. So what are movies you like? What are things you do on the internet? What do you and your friends do? And it's less about, you know, stuff you need. How well do you know Ramona? And more about, oh, Ramona likes the TV show Heartstoppers. Here's a question about Heartstoppers. Like, so theoretically, someone could come in off the street and know it. And then we have photos of the kid on the screen between the questions and stuff like that. So these events, usually the kids play, although the adults are invited to play. And it's an adaptation of my usual format, very interactive. Kids team up. We have the guest of honor, in this case, the kid, kind of like they float around and they help people who ask nicely enough. And they sort of help me judge the buzzer in the finale. It's fun. It's not for every kid. You know, the cool kids who just want to dance at their mitzvah, not really their entertainment for that. But, you know, the nerds and the dorks like me, it's great. I wish something like this had been around when I was a kid, which is part of the reason I like doing it now.
Very cool. All right. Yeah. I was curious about that. All right. Well, again, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it. Again, I knew I was going to have you on the show a while back. So I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this.
Three-fifths to a Robbie. So
that's right.
Getting there.
Hey, you're getting there. You already did Citizen Kane Minute, which is kind of like the hardest one because it was so specific and obscure. Right, and now that show's over too. So I think it's getting, and you've done Pod Dylan. So I mean,
I have an idea for Mountain Comics. I want to pitch to you.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
And we talked and I pitched you a few ideas for Film and Water. I'd like to do that. And, we talked once about, Treasury Comics, and there was one I had in mind that I don't think you've done yet. So we'll talk about it off, off record or whatever and see if we can work something out.
Sounds good. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some commercial announcements, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
All autumn, the leaves change colors and begin to fall. The kids go back to school. Pumpkin Spice becomes its own food group, and little ghosts and goblins are on the streets begging for candy. But something sinister awaits. Back in the woods among those dead trees sits a foreboding, dilapidated manor. You can't resist. You must go inside and return to
the House of Frankenstein.
Did you hear that?
I heard that. What was it?
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
The Supermates podcast presents four spine-tingling episodes covering your favorite classic horror films featuring these iconic stars.
Griffin Dunn and David Naughton.
You're one of the undead, and I'm a werewolf.
Yes, that's right.
Bela Lugosi.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
Claude Rains.
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? All right. I'll show you!
And Peter Cushing.
I can hear his voice.
It's in your own mind. It just has to be true.
Plus, your favorite superheroes versus classic monsters.
I understand your concern, Mr. Wayne, but I don't think you need to worry that Wayne Tech is responsible for this invisible man.
But I seem to remember last year hearing something about an invisibility project.
Visit fireandwaterpodcast.com or your favorite podcatcher for the 10th annual journey into terror at the House of Frankenstein.
Not available in pumpkin spice flavor.
It's fun to create with Crayola.
Crayola Caddy.
A Crayola Caddy spins around and round. Crayons, markers, brushes are so easily found. Paints and watercolors to use throughout the day. They're all in our caddy, and that is why we say it's fun to create with Crayola.
The Crayola Caddy comes with everything you see here.
And now it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on For All Mankind, episode 45, with my guest Chuck Dill. First up is Rob McCarthy, who says, odd fact that when I was really young in San Francisco, Super Friends was way more common than Justice League of America till the Detroit group. But when I say Super Friends was common, I mean issue 2. JLA, like Firestorm or G.I. Joe, much later, was at my great-grandma's 7-Eleven in Salinas. Very young Rob, if he still exists somewhere in the multiverse, is pretty glad he didn't buy a comic with two Green Lantern foes but no Green Lantern. Though in any universe where American slang and the Catholic Church evolved in the same way they did here, I rather doubt my oft-talked-about father would let me near a comic with Bushmaster on the cover. They probably should have stocked Super Friends next to like Guns and Ammo and heavy metal or something, Rob. Edo Boznar says, you know, I'm kind of with Chuck on the Bushmaster. The young me never gave him much thought, but looking at him now, I think he's pretty cool. I definitely think he merited one of those prestige post-crisis miniseries, if nothing else. Otherwise, I'm interested in seeing where this story goes. I'm hoping, though I'm sure those hopes will be dashed, that all the horny headgear, bovine, ovine, and cervine, worn by the various characters will come into play. And finally, as I did last time, a plastic man backup is featured. I'll reiterate my vote for a collection of the Pasco and Staten stories from this era. Absolutely, 8-0 co-signed. And the way that the Fire and Water Podcast Network seems to make things happen, I think we just need to keep talking about it enough, and eventually, somehow, it'll become part of the zeitgeist. Or, I'm sorry, using that word, and DC will do it. You never know. I mean, we have who on the buy for Pete's sakes. Brian Chufo says, begins yelling at clouds. I agree that the coloring in comics, which while definitely more advanced, isn't always an improvement and sometimes a detriment to storytelling. Where should I be looking around when the backgrounds and have as much coloring and highlights as shadows as the foreground? Does the eye color of a random person in the crowd need as much detail as the main character? Ends yelling at clouds. Yeah, Brian, I'm right there with you. I love computer coloring. I love being able to do all those tones, but it doesn't mean that you have to use them in every single place you can use them. Sometimes, you know, less is more. Super Captain says, thanks for this podcast. I recently binged the back episodes after discovering Who's Who show and binging it to keep my sanity during the early part of 2020. Super Friends is one of my earliest comic book memories. I especially loved anything that included the Global Guardians. My favorites were Seraph, Jack-O-Lantern, sorry, Rob, Rising Sun, and Beatrice DaCosta, the heroine futurally known as Fire. Number one had to be the Olympian, who inspired an early appreciation for Greek myths. You also can't go wrong with the bug-eyed greatness of Kanjar Ro. But instead of the whatchamacallit rod, the Conqueror should have targeted his Gamma Gong. And thanks for the reminder of Imagic's comic cosmic arc game for the Atari 2600. Imagic and Activision always put out the best cartridges back in the day. Agreed, Super Captain. I played Pitfall till my eyes fell out of my head, and I actually tried to stick a Pitfall ad in the show because I discovered a few of them on YouTube, but unfortunately, all, like, at least the ones I found were like mostly visual ads, and so as an audio only clip, it really didn't make any sense. It was just kind of random noises and then Pitfall. So that's why I went with Cosmic Arc, which I don't think I had. Anyway, Sean M. Myers from this very network says, hello, Chuck. Welcome to the podcast. I loved hearing your stories about growing up, and I can't wait to subscribe to Chuck's Childhood Podcast, coming soon on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. This issue and the next are great because it is so reminiscent of JLA stories and even harkens back to Super Friends 789. Chuck, I've recently made an enemy of Rob for my so-so ho-hum attitude towards Jim Aparo. So I will not tell you out loud that I agree with your original assessment of Romario Tango and Ramona Fraiden. Regarding Dr. Mist's headquarters and now how the heroes would enter, my guess is that they go through the drawbridge. Did Ange write this? No. Okay. As the Fire and Water Podcast Network's senior Speedo correspondent, the Conqueror's outfit did indeed register a few checks in the win column of costume appreciation. Thank you, Sean. There, Dr. Ange says, maybe he did write the last comment. Great episode on an issue I haven't read. Always liked when DC proper stuff leaked into the book. Sinestro! I feel lucky that the two issues I reviewed were deep dives into Black Orchid and Supergirl / Weather Wizard. Bushmaster just looks too much like Blue Falcon in some panels for me to take him too seriously. Do you think Bushmaster and Dynamite? Do you think Dr. Mist uses powers to make his tower or use demolitions a la Mount Rushmore? I can only imagine what he gives directions to his place. Fly to Africa, follow the river until you see my massive face. As someone who survived the blizzard of 78 and the ice storm of 80 in Rhode Island, as well as shoveling a long driveway, I could tell you snowstorms can completely suck. Yeah, they do, because at a certain point, once you grow past the age of worrying about whether you're going to school or not, they're just pains in the asses, you know? I work from home, I'm very fortunate like that, but it just makes everything more difficult. We spent part of last winter down in Florida, Kelly and I, and I'm hoping we maybe get to do that again, because 70-degree weather in December was awesome, although it was Florida. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Chuck. First, Chuck, you're not alone. I remember as a kid really liking the Tango Coletta art team better than the Fraiden Smith team. Guys, I don't feel that way now, of course. Oh, you saved it, Brett. But I still dig Tangal's renditions of Batman and Aquaman. Embrace the wavy aqua perm, Rob. Also, while it's cool your parents got you football cards, it's absolutely tragic that they gave you Dallas Cowboys pajamas. That's a potential supervillain origin story. Terrific issue. I love the big team stories where they split into smaller groups. The Global Guardians were always a welcome sight. I always thought it would be great for someone at DC to do a fun adventure series with them, which means we can rely on a dark 12-issue Tom King Global Guardians run where they're all secretly pervert war criminals working for Big Oil or something. I don't want to read that. Bucky749 says, another great show. Great to see Plastic Man back in action. Also, the story about an actor going rogue seems like one straight out of a Saturday morning cartoon to me. I think those Pasco Staten stories had a little bit of Saturday morning energy that would make sense. And don't think I didn't notice that you've mentioned our Saturday morning show once again, Bucky. You're always mentioning that on For All Mankind comments. Do you leave those comments on other shows about Saturday morning? I'm not the only one that does that show. And then finally, from our network, Chris Franklin says, what a great discussion. Like Chuck, I too was a big fan of Bushmaster. God, everyone loves Bushmaster. I legitimately thought his look was cool and especially loved his color scheme. I will also admit at the time, I think I preferred the Romeo Tango look. You guys are killing me. The heroes looked a bit more on model now per the then current comic. Now I totally feel the opposite. There we go. Although I still think the art is nice, particularly Tangle's Batman, as you guys pointed out. See, we think so much alike, Chuck, so let me come over and play with the Super Friend Cyborg figure. In fact, can I borrow it for a while? Chuck, be very careful. Anyway, thanks so much for the comments, everybody. I really appreciate it. Of course, you can find this show over on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. All the back episodes are on our website, FineWaterPodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford M. Brown, and Donald McWaters for their support of For All Mankind. I really appreciate it. Also have to thank Gord Tolton and David A. Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So that's going to do it. Thanks for listening to this episode of For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we will look at the final issue of Super Friends, The Demons from the Green Hell.
An FWTV podcast.